If Van Damme could guess the destination, Elena thought, then so could I. Where would Wolf have kept a spare radio? It was a long journey away. He might have hidden one somewhere before he reached Cairo. It might be somewhere in the desert, or somewhere between here and Asyut. Maybe... Billy came in.
Hello, he said to Elena. Did you bring me that book?
She did not know what he was talking about. Book? She stared at him, thinking that he was still very much a child, despite his grown-up ways. He wore gray flannel shorts and a white shirt, and there was no hair on the smooth skin of his bare forearm. He was carrying a school satchel and wearing a school tie.
This ends side one of cassette 8. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
You forgot, he said, and looked betrayed. You were going to lend me a detective story by Simenon. I did forget. I'm sorry. Will you bring it next time you come? Of course. Wolf had been staring at Billy all this time, like a miser looking into his treasure chest. Now he stood up. Hello, Billy, he said with a smile. I'm Captain Alexander. Billy shook hands and said, How do you do, sir?
Your father asked me to tell you that he's very busy indeed.
He always comes home for breakfast, Billy said.
Not today. He's pretty busy coping with old Rommel, you know.
Has he been in another fight? Wolf hesitated.
Matter of fact, he has, but he's okay. He got a bump on the head.
Billy seemed more proud than worried, Elena observed. Gafar came in and spoke to Wolf.
You are sure, sir, that the Major said you were to take the boy to school?
He is suspicious, Elena thought.
Of course, Wolf said. Is something wrong?
No, but I am responsible for Billy, and we don't actually know you.
But you'll know Miss Fontana, Wolf said. She was with me when Major Van Damme spoke to me, weren't you, Elena?
Wolf stared at her and touched himself under the left arm where the knife was sheathed.
Yes,
Elena said miserably.
Wolf said, However, you're quite right to be cautious, Gafar. Perhaps you should call GHQ and speak to the Major yourself.
He indicated the phone. Elena thought, No, don't, Gafar. He'll kill you before you finish dialing. Gafar hesitated, then said,
I'm sure that won't be necessary, sir. As you say, we know Miss Fontana.
Elena thought, It's all my fault. Gafar went out. Wolf spoke to Elena in rapid Arabic. Keep the boy quiet for a minute. He continued writing. Elena looked at Billy's satchel and had the glimmer of an idea.
Show me your school books, she said.
Billy looked at her as if she were crazy.
Come on, she said.
The satchel was open and an atlas stuck out. She reached for it.
What are you doing in geography? The Norwegian fjords.
Elena saw Wolf finish writing and put the sheet of paper in an envelope. He licked the flap, sealed the envelope, and put it in his pocket.
Let's find Norway, Elena said.
She flipped the pages of the atlas. Wolf picked up the telephone and dialed. He looked at Elena, then looked away out of the window. Elena found the map of Egypt. Billy said, But that's... Quickly, Elena touched his lips with her finger. He stopped speaking and frowned at her. She thought, Please, little boy, be quiet and leave this to me. She said,
Scandinavia, yes, but Norway is in Scandinavia. Look.
She unwrapped the handkerchief from around her hand. Billy stared at the cut. With her fingernail, Elena opened the cut and made it bleed again. Billy turned white. He seemed about to speak, so Elena touched his lips and shook her head with a pleading look. Elena was sure Wolf was going to Asyut. It was a likely guess, and Wolf had said he was afraid Van Damme would correctly guess their destination.
As she thought this, she heard Wolf say into the phone,
"Hello? Give me the time of the train to Asyut."
I was right, she thought. She dipped her finger in the blood from her hand. With three strokes, she drew an arrow in blood on the map of Egypt, with the point of the arrow on the town of Asyut, 300 miles south of Cairo. She closed the atlas. She used her handkerchief to smear blood on the cover of the book, then pushed the book behind her. Wolf said,
"Yes, and what time does it arrive?"
Elena said, "But why are there fjords in Norway and not in Egypt?" Billy seemed dumbstruck. He was staring at her hand. She had to make him snap out of it before he gave her away. She said, "Listen, did you ever read an Agatha Christie story called The Clue of the Blood-Stained Atlas?" "No, there's no such..." "It's very clever, the way the detective is able to figure everything out on the basis of that one clue." He frowned at her. But instead of the frown of the utterly amazed, it was the frown of one who is working something out. Wolf put down the phone and stood up.
"Let's go," he said. "You don't want to be late for school, Billy."
He went to the door and opened it. Billy picked up his satchel and went out. Elena stood up, dreading that Wolf would spot the atlas.
"Come on," he said impatiently.
She went through the door and he followed her. Billy was on the porch already. There was a little pile of letters on a kidney-shaped table in the hall. Elena saw Wolf drop his envelope on top of the pile. They went out through the front door. Wolf asked Elena,
"Can you drive?"
"Yes," she answered, then cursed herself for thinking slowly. She should have said no.
"You two get in the front," Wolf instructed.
He got in the back. As she pulled away, Elena saw Wolf lean forward. He said,
"See this?"
She looked down. He was showing the knife to Billy.
"Yes,"
Billy said in an unsteady voice.
Wolf said, "If you make trouble, I'll cut your head off."
Billy began to cry. Chapter 25.
"Stand to attention!"
Jakes barked in his sergeant major's voice. Kamel stood to attention. The interrogation room was bare but for a table. Van Damme followed Jakes in, carrying a chair in one hand and a cup of tea in the other. He sat down. Van Damme said, "Where is Alex Wolf?"
"I don't know,"
said Kamel, relaxing slightly.
"Attention!"
Jakes yelled.
"Stand straight, boy!"
Kamel came to attention again. Van Damme sipped his tea. It was part of the act, a way of saying that he had all the time in the world and was not very concerned about anything, whereas the prisoner was in real trouble. It was the reverse of the truth. He said, "Last night you received a call from the officer on surveillance at Houseboat Jihan." Jakes shouted, "Answer the major!"
"Yes,"
Kamel said. "What did he say to you?"
"He said that Major Van Damme had come to the towpath and sent him to summon assistance."
"Sir,"
said Jakes.
"To summon assistance, sir."
"To summon assistance, sir,"
Van Damme said. "And what did you do?"
"I went personally to the towpath to investigate, sir."
"And then?"
"I was struck on the head and knocked unconscious. When I recovered, I was bound hand and foot. It took me several hours to free myself. Then I freed Major Van Damme, whereupon he attacked me."
Jakes went close to Kamel.
"You're a bloody lying little bloody wog."
Kamel took a pace back.
"Stand forward," Jakes shouted. "You're a lying little wog. What are you?"
Kamel said nothing. Van Damme said, "Listen, Kamel, as things stand, you're going to be shot for spying. If you tell us all you know, you could get off with a prison sentence. Be sensible. Now you came to the towpath and knocked me out, didn't you?"
"No, sir."
Van Damme sighed. Kamel had his story, and he was sticking to it. Even if he knew or could guess where Wolf had gone, he would not reveal it while he was pretending innocence. Van Damme said, "What is your wife's involvement in all this?" Kamel said nothing, but he looked scared. Van Damme said. If you won't answer my questions, I'll have to ask her.
Kamel's lips were pressed together in a hard line. Van Damme stood up.
All right, Jakes, he said. Bring in the wife on suspicion of spying.
Kamel said, typical British justice.
Van Damme looked at him. Where is Wolf?
I don't know.
Van Damme went out. He waited outside the door for Jakes. When the captain came out, Van Damme said, he's a policeman. He knows the techniques. He'll break, but not today. And Van Damme had to find Wolf today.
Jakes asked, do you want me to arrest the wife?
Not yet. Maybe later.
And where was Elena?
They walked a few yards to another cell. Van Damme said, is everything ready here?
Yes.
Okay. He opened the door and went in. This room was not so bare. Sonia sat on a hard chair wearing a coarse gray prison dress. Beside her stood a woman army officer who would have scared Van Damme had he been her prisoner. She was short and stout, with a hard masculine face and short gray hair. There was a cot in one corner of the cell and a cold water basin in the other. As Van Damme walked in, the woman officer said, stand up. Van Damme and Jakes sat down. Van Damme said, sit down, Sonia. The woman officer pushed Sonia into the chair. Van Damme studied Sonia for a minute. He had interrogated her once before, and she had been stronger than he. It would be different this time. Elena's safety was in the balance, and Van Damme had few scruples left. He said, where is Alex Wolf?
I don't know.
Where is Elena Fontana?
I don't know.
Wolf is a German spy, and you have been helping him.
Ridiculous!
You're in trouble.
She said nothing.
Van Damme watched her face. She was proud, confident, unafraid.
Van Damme wondered what exactly had happened on the houseboat this morning. Surely Wolf had gone off without warning Sonia.
Did she not feel betrayed?
Wolf betrayed you,
Van Damme said.
Kamel, the policeman, warned Wolf of the danger, but Wolf left you sleeping and went off with another woman. Are you going to protect him after that?
She said nothing.
Wolf kept his radio on your boat. He sent messages to Rommel at midnight. You knew this, so you were an accessory to espionage. You're going to be shot for spying.
All Cairo will riot. You wouldn't dare.
You think so?
What do we care if Cairo riots now? The Germans are at the gates. Let them put down the rebellion.
You dare not touch me.
Where has Wolf gone?
I don't know.
Can you guess?
No.
You're not being helpful, Sonia. It will make things worse for you.
You can't touch me.
I think I'd better prove to you that I can. Van Damme nodded to the woman officer.
The woman held Sonia still while Jakes tied her to the chair. She struggled for a moment, but it was hopeless. She looked at Van Damme, and for the first time there was a hint of fear in her eyes. She said, what are you doing, you bastards?
The woman officer took a large pair of scissors from her bag. She lifted a hank of Sonia's long, thick hair and cut it off.
You can't do this! Sonia shrieked.
Swiftly, the woman cut Sonia's hair. As the heavy locks fell away, the woman dropped them in Sonia's lap. Sonia screamed, cursing Van Damme and Jakes and the British in language which Van Damme had never heard from a woman.
The woman officer took a smaller pair of scissors and cropped Sonia's hair close to the scalp. Sonia's screams subsided into tears.
When he could be heard, Van Damme said, you see, we don't care much about legality and justice anymore. Nor do we care about Egyptian public opinion. We've got our backs to the wall. We may all be killed soon. We're desperate.
The woman took soap and a shaving brush and lathered Sonia's head, then began to shave her scalp.
Van Damme said, Wolf was getting information from someone at GHQ.
Who?
You're evil, said Sonia.
Finally, the woman officer took a mirror from her bag and held it in front of Sonia's face. At first, Sonia would not look in the glass,
but after a moment she gave in. She gasped when she saw the reflection of her totally bald head.
No, she said. It's not me.
She burst into tears. All the hatred was gone now. She was completely demoralized. Van Damme said softly, where was Wolf getting his information?
From Major Smith, Sonia replied.
Van Damme heaved a sigh of relief. She had broken. Thank God.
First name? He asked.
Sandy Smith.
Van Damme glanced at Jake's. That was the name of the major who had disappeared.
It was as they had feared.
How did he get the information?
Sandy came to the houseboat in his lunch break to visit me. While we were in bed, Alex went through his briefcase.
As simple as that, Van Damme thought. Jesus, I feel tired.
Smith was liaison man between the Secret Intelligence Service, also known as MI6, and GHQ. And in that role, he had been privy to all strategic planning. For MI6 needed to know what the Army was doing so that it could tell its spies what information to look for. Smith had been going straight from the morning conferences at GHQ to the houseboat, with a briefcase full of secrets. Van Damme had already learned that Smith had been telling people at GHQ he was lunching at the MI6 office, and telling his superiors at MI6 he was lunching at GHQ, so that nobody would know he was screwing a dancer. Van Damme had previously assumed Wolf was bribing or blackmailing someone. It had never occurred to him that Wolf might be getting information from someone without that someone's knowledge. Van Damme said, "Where is Smith now?"
"He caught Alex going through his briefcase. Alex killed him."
"Where's the body?"
"In the river by the houseboat."
Van Damme nodded to Jake's, and Jake's went out.
Van Damme said to Sonia, "Tell me about Kamel."
She was in full flood now, eager to tell all she knew, her resistance quite crushed. She would do anything to make people be nice to her.
"He came and told me you had asked him to have the houseboat watched. He said he would censor his surveillance reports if I would arrange a meeting between Alex and Sadat."
"Alex and whom?"
"Anwar El Sadat. He's a captain in the army."
"Why did he want to meet Wolf?"
"So the free officers could send a message to Rommel."
Van Damme thought, "There are elements to this that I never thought of."
He said, "Where does Sadat live?" "Kubri al-Kuba."
"The address?"
"I don't know."
Van Damme said to the woman officer, "Go and find out the exact address of Captain Anwar El Sadat."
"Yes, sir."
The woman's face broke into a smile that was astonishingly pretty. She went out. Van Damme said, "Wolf kept his radio on your houseboat."
"Yes."
"He used a code for his messages."
"Yes, he had an English novel which he used to use to make up the code words."
"Rebecca."
"Yes."
"And he had a key to the code."
"A key?"
"A piece of paper telling him which pages of the book to use."
She nodded slowly. "Yes, I think he did."
"The radio, the book, and the key have gone. Do you know where?"
"No," she said. She got scared. "Honestly, no, I don't know. I'm telling the truth."
"It's all right. I believe you. Do you know where Wolf might have gone?"
"He has a house. Villa Les Oliviers."
"Good idea. Any other suggestions?"
"Abdullah. He might have gone to Abdullah."
"Yes. Any more?"
"His cousins, in the desert."
"And where would they be found?"
"No one knows. They're nomads."
"Might Wolf know their movements?"
"I suppose he might."
Van Damme sat looking at her for a little while longer. She was no actress. She could not have faked this. She was totally broken down, not only willing but eager to betray her friends and tell all her secrets. She was telling the truth. "I'll see you again," Van Damme said, and went out. The woman officer handed him a slip of paper with Sadat's address on it, then went into the cell. Van Damme hurried to the muster room. Jake's was waiting.
"The Navy is lending us a couple of divers," Jake said. "They'll be here in a few minutes."
"Good." Van Damme lit a cigarette. I want you to raid Abdullah's place. I'm going to arrest this Sadat fellow. Send a small team to the Villa Les Oliviers, just in case. I don't suppose they'll find anything. Has everyone been briefed? Jakes nodded. They know we're looking for a wireless transmitter, a copy of Rebecca, and a set of coding instructions. Van Damme looked around, and noticed for the first time that there were Egyptian policemen in the room. Why have we got bloody Arabs on the team? He said angrily. Protocol, sir, Jakes replied formally. Colonel Boggs' idea. Van Damme bit back a retort. After you've done Abdullah, meet me at the houseboat. Yes, sir. Van Damme stubbed his cigarette. Let's go. They went out into the morning sunshine. A dozen or more jeeps were lined up, their engines idling. Jakes gave instructions to the sergeants and the raiding parties, then nodded to Van Damme. The men boarded the jeeps, and the teams pulled out. Sadat lived in a suburb 3 miles out of Cairo, in the direction of Heliopolis. His home was an ordinary family house in a small garden. 4 jeeps roared up outside, and the soldiers immediately surrounded the house and began to search the garden. Van Damme rapped on the front door. A dog began to bark loudly. Van Damme knocked again. The door was opened. Captain Anwar El Sadat? Yes. Sadat was a thin, serious young man of medium height. His curly brown hair was already receding. He wore his captain's uniform and fez, as if he was about to go out. You're under arrest, Van Damme said, and pushed past him into the house. Another young man appeared in a doorway. Who is he? Van Damme demanded. My brother, Talat, said Sadat. Van Damme looked at Sadat. The Arab was calm and dignified, but he was hiding some tension. He's afraid, Van Damme thought, but he's not afraid of me, and he's not afraid of going to prison. He's afraid of something else. What kind of deal had Kamel done with Wolf this morning? The rebels needed Wolf to help them get in touch with Rommel. Were they hiding Wolf somewhere? Van Damme said, Which is your room, Captain? Sadat pointed. Van Damme went into the room. It was a simple bedroom with a mattress on the floor and a galabia hanging from a hook. Van Damme pointed to 2 British soldiers and an Egyptian policeman and said, All right, go ahead. They began to search the room. What is the meaning of this? Sadat said quietly. You know Alex Wolf, Van Damme said. No. He also calls himself Ahmed Ramha, but he's a European. I've never heard of him. Clearly, Sadat was a fairly tough personality, not the kind to break down and confess everything just because a few burly soldiers started messing up his house. Van Damme pointed across the hall. What's that room?
My study.
Van Damme went to the door. Sadat said,
But the women of the family are in there. You must let me warn them.
They know we're here. Open the door. Van Damme let Sadat enter the room first. There were no women inside, but a back door was open as if someone had just stepped out. That was okay. The garden was full of soldiers. No one would escape. Van Damme saw an army pistol on the desk holding down some sheets of paper covered with Arabic script. He went to the bookshelf and examined the books. Rebecca was not there. A shout came from another part of the house. Major Van Damme! Van Damme followed the sound into the kitchen. A sergeant MP was standing beside the oven, with the house dog yapping at his booted feet. The oven door stood open, and the sergeant lifted out a suitcase radio. Van Damme looked at Sadat, who had followed him into the kitchen. The Arab's face was twisted with bitterness and disappointment. So this was the deal they had done. They warned Wolf, and in exchange, they got his radio. Did that mean he had another? Or had Wolf arranged to come here to Sadat's house to broadcast? Van Damme spoke to his sergeant. Well done. Take Captain Sadat to GHQ.
I protest, Sadat said. The law states that officers in the Egyptian army may be detained only in the officer's mess and must be guarded by a fellow officer.
The senior Egyptian policeman was standing nearby. This is correct, he said. Once again, Van Damme cursed Bog for bringing the Egyptians into this.
The law also states that spies are to be shot, he told Sadat. He turned to the sergeant. Send out my driver. Finish searching the house, then have Sadat charged with espionage. He looked again at Sadat. The bitterness and disappointment had gone from his face, to be replaced by a calculating look. He's figuring out how to make the most of all this, Van Damme thought. He's preparing to play martyr. He's very adaptable. He should be a politician. Van Damme left the house and went out to the jeep. A few moments later, his driver came running out and jumped into the seat beside him. Van Damme said, To Zamalek. Yes, sir. The driver started the jeep and pulled away. When Van Damme reached the houseboat, the divers had done their work and were standing on the towpath, getting out of their gear. Two soldiers were hauling something extremely grisly out of the Nile. The divers had attached ropes to the body they had found on the bottom and then washed their hands of the affair. Jakes came over to Van Damme. Look at this, sir. He handed him a waterlogged book. The board covers had been torn off. Van Damme examined the book. It was Rebecca. The radio went to Sadat. The code book went into the river. Van Damme remembered the ashtray full of charred paper in the houseboat. Had Wolf burned the key to the code? Why had he gotten rid of the radio, the book, and the key when he had a vital message to send to Rommel? The conclusion was inescapable. He had another radio, book, and key hidden away somewhere. The soldiers got the body onto the bank and then stepped back, as if they wanted nothing more to do with it. Van Damme stood over it. The throat had been cut, and the head was almost severed from the body. A briefcase was roped to the waist. Van Damme bent down and gingerly opened the case. It was full of bottles of champagne. Jake said, My God! Ugly, isn't it? Van Damme said. Throat cut, then dumped in the river with a case of champagne to weigh him down. Cool, bastard! And damn quick with that knife! Van Damme touched his cheek. The dressing had been taken off now, and several days' growth of beard hid the wound. But not Elena. Not with the knife, please. I gather you haven't found him.
I haven't found anything. I've had Abdullah brought in just on general principles, but there was nothing at his house. And I called in at the Villa Les Oliviers on the way back. Same story.
And at Captain Sadat's house. Suddenly Van Damme felt utterly drained. It seemed that Wolf outwitted him at every turn. It occurred to him that he might simply not be smart enough to catch this sly, evasive spy. Perhaps we've lost, he said. He rubbed his face. He had not slept in the last 24 hours. He wondered what he was doing here, standing over the hideous corpse of Major Sandy Smith. There was no more to be learned from it. I think I'll go home and sleep for an hour, he said. Jakes looked surprised. Van Damme added, It might help me think more clearly. This afternoon we'll interrogate all the prisoners again.
Very good, sir.
Van Damme walked back to his vehicle. Driving across the bridge from Zamalek to the mainland, he recalled that Sonia had mentioned one other possibility, Wolf's nomad cousins. He looked at the boats on the wide, slow river. The current took them downstream, and the wind blew them upstream. A coincidence of enormous importance to Egypt. The boatmen were still using the single triangular sail, a design which had been perfected how long ago? Thousands of years, perhaps. So many things in this country were done the way they had been done for thousands of years. Van Damme closed his eyes and saw Wolf in a felucca sailing upriver, manipulating the triangular sail with one hand, while with the other he tapped out messages to Rommel on the transmitter. The car stopped suddenly, and Van Damme opened his eyes, realizing he had been daydreaming, or dozing. Why would Wolf go upriver? To find his nomad cousins. But who could tell where they would be? Wolf might be able to find them if they followed some annual pattern in their wanderings. The jeep had stopped outside Van Damme's house. He got out. I want you to wait for me, he told the driver. You'd better come in. He led the way into the house, then directed the driver to the kitchen. My servant Gafar will give you something to eat.
so long as you don't treat him like a wog.
Thank you very much, sir, said the driver.
There was a small stack of mail on the hall table. The top envelope had no stamp and was addressed to Van Damme in a vaguely familiar hand. It had urgent scribbled in the top left-hand corner. Van Damme picked it up. There was more he should do, he realized. Wolf could well be heading south now. Roadblocks should be set up at all major towns on the route. There should be someone at every stop on the railway line looking for Wolf. And the river itself. There had to be some way of checking the river in case Wolf really had gone by boat, as in the daydream. Van Damme was finding it hard to concentrate. We could set up river blocks on the same principle as roadblocks, he thought. Why not? None of it would be any good if Wolf had simply gone to ground in Cairo. Suppose he were hiding in the cemeteries. Many Muslims buried their dead in tiny houses, and there were acres of such empty buildings in the city. Van Damme would have needed 1,000 men to search them all. Perhaps I should do it anyway, he thought. But Wolf might have gone north, toward Alexandria, or east or west, into the desert. He went into the drawing room, looking for a letter opener. Somehow the search had to be narrowed down. Van Damme did not have thousands of men at his disposal. They were all in the desert, fighting. He had to decide what was the best bet. He remembered where all this had started. Assiut. Perhaps he should contact Captain Newman in Assiut. That seemed to be where Wolf had come in from the desert, so maybe he would go out that way. Maybe his cousins were in that vicinity. Van Damme looked indecisively at the telephone. Where was that damned letter opener? He went to the door and called, Gafar! He came back into the room and saw Billy's school atlas on a chair. It looked mucky. The boy had dropped it in a puddle or something. He picked it up. It was sticky. Van Damme realized there was blood on it. He felt as if he were in a nightmare. What was going on? No letter opener, blood on the atlas, nomads at Assiut. Gafar came in. Van Damme said, What's this mess? Gafar looked.
I'm sorry, sir, I don't know. They were looking at it while Captain Alexander was here.
Who's they? Who's Captain Alexander?
The officer you sent to take Billy to school, sir. His name was...
Stop. A terrible fear cleared Van Damme's brain in an instant. A British Army captain came here this morning and took Billy away?
Yes, sir. He took him to school. He said you sent him...
Gafar. I sent nobody. The servant's brown face turned gray. Van Damme said, Didn't you check that he was genuine?
But, sir, Miss Fontana was with him, so it seemed all right.
Oh, my God. Van Damme looked at the envelope in his hand. Now he knew why the handwriting was familiar. It was the same as that on the note that Wolf had sent to Elena. He ripped open the envelope. Inside was a message in the same hand. Dear Major Van Damme, Billy is with me. Elena is taking care of him. He will be quite all right as long as I am safe. I advise you to stay where you are and do nothing. We do not make war on children, and I have no wish to harm the boy. All the same, the life of one child is as nothing beside the future of my two nations, Egypt and Germany. So be assured that if it suits my purpose, I will kill Billy. Yours truly, Alex Wolf. It was a letter from a madman. The polite salutations, the correct English, the semicolon, the attempt to justify the kidnapping of an innocent child. Now Van Damme knew that, somewhere deep down inside, Wolf was insane. And he had Billy. Van Damme handed the note to Gafar, who put on his spectacles with a shaky hand. Wolf had taken Elena with him when he left the houseboat. It would not have been difficult to coerce her into helping him. All he had to do was threaten Billy, and she would have been helpless. But what was the point of the kidnap, really? And where had they gone? And why the blood? Gafar was weeping openly. Van Damme said, Who was hurt? Who was bleeding?
There was no violence, Gafar said. I think Miss Fontana had cut her hand.
and she had smeared blood on Billy's atlas and left it on the chair. It was a sign, a message of some kind. Van Damme held the book in his hands and let it fall open. Immediately he saw the map of Egypt with a blotted red arrow roughly drawn. It pointed to Assyut. Van Damme picked up the phone and dialed GHQ. When the switchboard answered, he hung up. He thought, if I report this, what will happen? Bog will order a squad of light infantry to arrest Wolf at Assyut. There will be a fight. Wolf will know he has lost. Know he is to be shot for spying, not to mention kidnapping and murder. And what will he do then? He is insane, Van Damme thought. He will kill my son. He felt paralyzed by fear. Of course that was what Wolf wanted. That was his aim in taking Billy, to paralyze Van Damme. That was how kidnapping worked. If Van Damme brought the army in, there would be a shootout. Wolf might kill Billy out of mad spite. So there was only one option. Van Damme had to go after them alone. Get me 2 bottles of water, he told Gafar. The servant went off. Van Damme went into the hall and put on his motorcycle goggles, then found a scarf and wound it around his mouth and neck. Gafar came from the kitchen with the bottles of water. Van Damme left the house and went to his motorcycle. He climbed on the bike. He kicked it into life and revved the engine. The fuel tank was full. Gafar stood beside him, still weeping. Van Damme touched the old man's shoulder. I'll bring them back, he said. He rocked the bike off its stand, drove into the street, and turned south. Chapter 26. My God, the station was a shambles. I suppose everyone wants to get out of Cairo in case it gets bombed. No first-class seats on the trains to Palestine. Not even standing room. The wives and children of the British are running like rats. Fortunately, southbound trains are less in demand. The booking office still claimed there were no seats. But they always say that. A few piastres here and a few more there always gets a seat, or three. I was afraid I might lose Elena and the boy on the platform, among all the hundreds of peasants, barefoot in their dirty galabiyas, carrying boxes tied with string, chickens in crates, sitting on the platform eating their breakfast. A fat mother in black handing out boiled eggs and pita bread and caked rice to her husband and sons, cousins and daughters and in-laws. Smart idea of mine, to hold the boy's hand. If I keep him close by, Elena will follow. Smart idea. I have smart ideas. Christ, I'm smart. Smarter than Van Damme. Eat your heart out, Major Van Damme. I've got your son. Somebody had a goat on a lead. Fancy taking a goat on a train ride. I never had to travel economy with the peasants and their goats. What a job to clean the economy coach at the end of the journey. I wonder who does it. Some poor fella. A different breed. A different race. Born slaves. Thank God we got first-class seats. I travel first class through life. I hate dirt. God, that station was dirty. Vendors on the platform. Cigarettes, newspapers. A man with a huge basket of bread on his head. I like the women when they carry baskets on their heads, looking so graceful and proud. Makes you want to do it to them, there and then, standing up. I like women when they like to do it, when they lose their minds with pleasure, when they scream, Gesundheit. Look at Elena, sitting there beside the boy. So frightened, so beautiful. I want to do it with her again soon. Forget Sonia. I'd like to do it with Elena right now, here on the train, in front of all these people. Humiliate her, with Van Damme's son watching, terrified. Huh. Look at the mud-brick suburbs. Houses leaning against one another for support. Cows and sheep in the narrow, dusty streets. I always wondered what they ate, those city sheep with their fat tails. Where do they graze? No plumbing in those dark little houses beside the railway line. Women in the doorways peeling vegetables, sitting cross-legged on the dusty ground. Cats. So graceful, the cats. European cats are different, slower and much fatter. No wonder cats are sacred here. They are so beautiful. A kitten brings luck. The English like dogs. Disgusting animals, dogs. Unclean, undignified, slobbering, fawning, sniffing. A cat is superior and knows it. It is so important to be superior. One is a master or a slave. I hold my head up like a cat. I walk about ignoring the hoi polloi, intent on my own mysterious tasks, using people the way a cat uses its owner, giving no thanks and accepting no affection, taking what they offer as a right, not a gift. I'm a master, a German Nazi, an Egyptian Bedouin, a born ruler. How many hours to Asiut? 8? 10? Must move fast. Find Ishmael. He should be at the well, or not far away. Pick up the radio. Broadcast at midnight tonight. Complete British defense. What a coup. They'll give me medals. Germans in charge in Cairo. Oh boy, we'll get the place into shape. What a combination. Germans and Egyptians. Efficiency by day and sensuality by night. Teutonic technology and Bedouin savagery. Beethoven and hashish. If I can survive, make it to Asiut, contact Rommel. Then Rommel can cross the last bridge, destroy the last line of defense, dash to Cairo, annihilate the British. What a victory that will be. If I can make it. What a triumph. What a triumph. What a triumph.
This ends side 2 of cassette 8 of The Key to Rebecca. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 9. Rebecca, cassette 9.
I will not be sick. I will not be sick. I will not be sick. The train says it for me, rattling on the tracks. I'm too old to throw up on trains now. I used to do that when I was 8. Dad took me to Alexandria, bought me candy and oranges and lemonade. I ate too much. Don't think about it. It makes me ill to think about it. Dad said it wasn't my fault. It was his. But I always used to feel sick, even if I didn't eat. Today, Elena bought chocolate, but I said no thanks. I'm pretty grown up to say no to chocolate. Kids never say no to chocolate. Look, I can see the pyramids. 1, 2, and the little one makes 3. This must be Giza. Where are we going? He was supposed to take me to school. Then he got out the knife. It's curved. He'll cut off my head. Where's Dad? I should be in school. We have geography in the first period today, a test on the Norwegian fjords. I learned it all last night. I needn't have bothered. I've missed the test. They've already finished it by now, Mr. Johnstone collecting up the papers. You call that a map, Higgins? Looks more like a drawing of your ear, boy. Everybody laughs. Smythe can't spell Musk and Strauman. Write it 50 times, lad. Everyone is glad he isn't Smythe. Old Johnstone opens the textbook. Next, the Arctic tundra. I wish I was in school. I wish Elena would put her arm around me. I wish the man would stop looking at me, staring at me like that, so pleased with himself. I think he's crazy. Where's Dad? If I don't think about the knife, it will be just as if it wasn't there. I mustn't think about the knife. If I concentrate on not thinking about the knife, that's the same as thinking about the knife. It's impossible to deliberately not think about something. How does anyone stop thinking of something? Accidentally. Accidental thoughts.
All thoughts are accidental. There, I stopped thinking about the knife for a second. If I see a policeman, I'll rush up to him and yell, "Save me, save me." I'll be so quick that he won't be able to stop me. I can run like the wind. I'm quick. I might see an officer. I might see a general. I'll shout, "Good morning, General." He'll look at me surprised and say, "Well, young fellow, me lad, you're a fine boy." "Pardon me, sir," I'll say. "I'm Major Van Damme's son, and this man is taking me away, and my father doesn't know. I'm sorry to trouble you, but I need help." "What?" says the general. "Look here, sir, you can't do this to the son of a British officer. Not cricket, you know. Just clear off, do you hear? Who the devil do you think you are? And you needn't flash that little penknife at me. I've got a pistol. You're a brave lad, Billy." "I'm a brave lad. All day men get killed in the desert. Bombs fall, back home. Ships in the Atlantic get sunk by U-boats. Men fall into the icy water and drown. RAF chaps shot down over France. Everybody is brave. Chin up. Damn this war. That's what they say, damn this war. Then they climb into the cockpit, hurry down the air raid shelter, attack the next dune, fire torpedoes at the U-boats, write letters home. I used to think it was exciting. Now I know better. It isn't exciting at all. It makes you feel sick." Billy is so pale. He looks it. He's trying to be brave. He shouldn't. He should act like a child. He should scream and cry and throw a tantrum. Wolf couldn't cope with that. But he won't, of course, for he has been taught to be tough, to bite back the cry, to suppress the tears, to have self-control. He knows how his father would be. What else does a boy do but copy his father? Look at Egypt. A canal alongside the railway line. A grove of date palms. A man crouching in a field, his galabiyah hitched up above his long white undershorts, doing something to the crops. An ass grazing, so much healthier than the miserable specimens you see pulling carts in the city. Three women sitting beside the canal, washing clothes, pounding them on stones to get them clean. A man on horseback, galloping. Must be the local effendi. Only the richest peasants have horses. In the distance, the lush green countryside ends abruptly in a range of dusty tan hills. Egypt is only 30 miles wide, really. The rest is desert. What am I going to do? That chill deep in my chest every time I look at Wolf. The way he stares at Billy. The gleam in his eye. His restlessness. The way he looks out of the window, then around the carriage, then at Billy, then at me, then at Billy again. Always with that gleam in his eye, the look of triumph. I should comfort Billy. I wish I knew more about boys. I had 4 sisters. What a poor stepmother I should be for Billy. I'd like to touch him, put my arm around him, give him a quick squeeze, or even a cuddle. But I'm not sure that's what he wants. It might make him feel worse. Perhaps I could take his mind off things by playing a game. What a ridiculous idea. Perhaps not so ridiculous. Here is his school satchel. Here is an exercise book. He looks at me curiously. What game? Noughts and crosses. 4 lines for the grid, my cross in the center. The way he looks at me as he takes the pencil, I do believe he's going along with this crazy idea in order to comfort me. His knot in the corner. Wolf snatches the book, looks at it, shrugs, and gives it back. My cross, Billy's knot. It will be a drawn game. I should let him win next time. I can play this game without thinking, more's the pity. Wolf has a spare radio at Assiut. Perhaps I should stay with him and try to prevent him using the radio. Some hope. I have to get Billy away, then contact Van Damme and tell him where I am. I hope Van Damme saw the Atlas.
Perhaps the servant saw it and called GHQ. Perhaps it will lie on the chair all day unnoticed. Perhaps Van Damme will not go home today. I have to get Billy away from Wolf, away from that knife. Billy makes a cross in the center of a new grid. I make a naught, then scribble hastily, "We must escape. Be ready." Billy makes another cross and, "Okay." My naught. Billy's cross and, "When?" My naught and, "Next station." Billy's third cross makes a line. He scores through the line of crosses, then smiles up at me jubilantly. He has won. The train slows down. Van Damme knew the train was still ahead of him. He had stopped at the station at Giza, close to the pyramids, to ask how long ago the train had passed through. Then he had stopped and asked the same question at three subsequent stations. Now, after traveling for an hour, he had no need to stop and ask, for the road and the railway line ran parallel on either side of a canal, and he would see the train when he caught up with it. Each time he stopped, he had taken a drink of water. With his uniform cap, his goggles, and the scarf around his mouth and neck, he was protected from the worst of the dust. But the sun was terribly hot, and he was continually thirsty. Eventually, he realized he was running a slight fever. He thought he must have caught cold last night, lying on the ground beside the river for hours. His breath was hot in his throat, and the muscles of his back ached. He had to concentrate on the road. It was the only road which ran the length of Egypt, from Cairo to Aswan, and consequently much of it was paved. And in recent months, the army had done some repair work, but he still had to watch for bumps and potholes. Fortunately, the road ran straight as an arrow, so he could see, far ahead, the hazards of cattle, wagons, camel trains, and flocks of sheep. He drove very fast, except through the villages and towns, where at any moment people might wander out into the road. He would not kill a child to save a child, not even to save his own child. So far he had passed only two cars, a ponderous Rolls-Royce and a battered Ford. The Rolls had been driven by a uniformed chauffeur with an elderly English couple in the back seat, and the old Arabs. By now Van Damme was fairly sure Wolf was traveling by train. Suddenly he heard a distant hoot. Looking ahead and to his left, he saw at least a mile away a rising plume of white smoke, which was unmistakably that of a steam engine. Billy, he thought. Elena. He went faster. Paradoxically, the engine smoke made him think of England, of gentle slopes, endless green fields, a square church tower peeping over the tops of a cluster of oak trees, and a railway line through the valley with a puffing engine disappearing into the distance. For a moment, he was in that English valley, tasting the damp air of morning. Then the vision passed, and he saw again the steel-blue African sky, the paddy fields, the palm trees, and the far brown cliffs. The train was coming into a town. Van Damme did not know the names of the places anymore. His geography was not that good, and he had rather lost track of the distance he had traveled. It was a small town. It would have three or four brick buildings and a market. The train was going to get there before him. He had made his plans. He knew what he was going to do. But he needed time. It was impossible for him to rush into the station and jump on the train without making preparations. He reached the town and slowed right down. The street was blocked by a small flock of sheep. From a doorway, an old man smoking a hookah watched Van Damme. A European on a motorcycle would be a rare but not unknown sight. An ass tied to a tree snarled at the bike. A water buffalo drinking from a bucket did not even look up. Two filthy children in rags ran alongside, holding imaginary handlebars and saying, "Brum, brum," in imitation. Van Damme saw the station. From the square, he could not see the platform, for that was obscured by a long, low station building. But he could observe the exit and see anyone who came out. He would wait outside until the train left, just in case Wolf got off. Then he would go ahead and reach the next stop in plenty of time. He brought the motorcycle to a halt and killed the engine. The train rolled slowly over a level crossing. Elena saw the patient faces of the people behind the gate, waiting for the train to pass so that they could cross the line. A fat man on a donkey. A very small boy leading a camel. A horse-drawn cab. A group of silent old women. The camel couched. The boy began to beat it about the face with a stick, and then the scene slid sideways out of view. In a moment, the train would be in the station. Elena's courage deserted her. Not this time, she thought. I haven't had time to think of a plan. The next station. Let me leave it until the next station. But she had told Billy they would try to get away at this station. If she did nothing, he would not trust her any longer. It had to be this time. She tried to devise a plan. What was her priority? To get Billy away from Wolf. That was the only thing that counted. Give Billy a chance to run, then try to prevent Wolf from giving chase. She had a sudden vivid memory of a childhood fight in a filthy slum street in Alexandria. A big boy, a bully, hitting her, and another boy intervening and struggling with the bully. The smaller boy shouting to her, "Run, run!" while she stood watching the fight, horrified but fascinated. She could not remember how it had ended. She looked around. Think quickly. They were in an open carriage with 15 or 20 rows of seats. She and Billy sat side by side, facing forward. Wolf was opposite them. Beside him was an empty seat. Behind him was the exit door to the platform. The other passengers were a mixture of Europeans and wealthy Egyptians, all of them in Western clothing. Everyone was hot, weary, and enervated. Several people were asleep. The trainmaster was serving tea and glasses to a group of Egyptian army officers at the far end of the carriage. Through the window she saw a small mosque, then a French courthouse, then the station. A few trees grew in the dusty soil beside the concrete platform. An old man sat cross-legged beneath a tree, smoking a cigarette. Six boyish-looking Arab soldiers were crowded onto one small bench. A pregnant woman carried a baby in her arms. The train stopped. Not yet, Elena thought. Not yet. The time to move would be when the train was about to pull out again. That would give Wolf less time to catch them. She sat feverishly still. There was a clock on the platform with Roman numerals. It had stopped at 5 to 5. A man came to the window offering fruit drinks, and Wolf waved him away. A priest in Coptic robes boarded the train and took the seat next to Wolf, saying politely, "Vous permettez, monsieur?" Wolf smiled charmingly and replied, "Je vous en prie." Elena murmured to Billy, "When the whistle blows, run for the door and get off the train." Her heart beat faster. Now she was committed. Billy said nothing. Wolf said, "What was that?" Elena looked away. The whistle blew. Billy looked at Elena, hesitating. Wolf frowned. Elena threw herself at Wolf, reaching for his face with her hands. She was suddenly possessed by rage and hatred toward him for the humiliation, anxiety, and pain he had inflicted on her. He put up his arms protectively, but they did not stop her rush. Her strength astonished her. She raked his face with her fingernails and saw blood spurt. The priest gave a shout of surprise. Over the back of Wolf's seat, she saw Billy run to the door and struggle to open it. She collapsed on Wolf, banging her face against his forehead. She lifted herself again and tried to scratch his eyes. At last he found his voice and roared with anger. He pushed himself out of his seat, driving Elena backward. She grabbed at him and caught hold of his shirt front with both hands. Then he hit her. His hand came up from below his waist, bunched into a fist, then struck the side of her jaw. She had not known a punch could hurt so much. For an instant she could not see. She lost her grip on Wolf's shirt and fell back into her seat. Her vision returned, and she saw him heading for the door. She stood up. Billy had got the door open. She saw him fling it wide and jump onto the platform. Wolf leaped after him. Elena ran to the door. Billy was racing along the platform, running like the wind. Wolf was charging after him. The few Egyptians standing around were looking on, mildly astonished and doing nothing. Elena stepped down from the train and ran after Wolf. The train shook about to move. Wolf put on a burst of speed. Elena yelled, "Run, Billy, run!" Billy looked over his shoulder. He was almost at the exit now. A ticket collector in a raincoat stood there, looking on open-mouthed. Elena thought, "They won't let him out. He has no ticket." It did not matter, she realized, for the train was now inching forward, and Wolf had to get back on it. Wolf looked at the train, but did not slow his pace. Elena saw that Wolf was not going to catch Billy, and she thought, "We did it." Then Billy fell. He had slipped on something, a patch of sand or a leaf. He lost his balance completely and went flying through the air, carried by the momentum of his running, to hit the ground hard. Wolf was on him in a flash, bending to lift him. Elena caught up with them and jumped on Wolf's back. Wolf stumbled, losing his grip on Billy. Elena clung to Wolf. The train was moving slowly but steadily. Wolf grabbed Elena's arms, broke her grip, and shook his wide shoulders, throwing her to the ground. For a moment she lay stunned. Looking up, she saw that Wolf had thrown Billy across his shoulder. The boy was yelling and hammering on Wolf's back without effect. Wolf ran alongside the moving train for a few paces, then jumped in through an open door. Elena wanted to stay where she was, never to see Wolf again. But she could not leave Billy. She struggled to her feet. She ran, stumbling, alongside the train. Someone reached out a hand to her. She took it and jumped. She was aboard. She had failed miserably. She was back where she started. She felt crushed. She followed Wolf through the carriages back to their seats. She did not look at the faces of the people she passed. She saw Wolf give Billy one sharp smack on the bottom and dump him into his seat. The boy was crying silently. Wolf turned to Elena. "You silly, crazy girl," he said loudly for the benefit of the other passengers. He grabbed her arm and pulled her closer to him. He slapped her face with the palm of his hand, then with the back.